7. What Pokey Slidell says under a burning autumn sky, with the sound of the season's last crickets rising from the high white grass on either side of them, is, "It's been good to know you, Jamie Jeffords, say true." He's got a smile on his face like none Jamie has ever seen before, but being only 19 and living way out here on what some call the Rim and others call the Crescent, there's plenty he's never seen before. Or will ever see, way it looks now. It's a sick smile, but there's no cowardice in it. Jamie guesses he's wearing one just like it. Here they are under the sun of their fathers, and the darkness will soon have them. They've come to their dying hour. Nonetheless, his grip is strong when he seizes Pokey's hand.
"You ain't done knowing me yet, Pokey," he says.
"Hope you're right." The dust cloud moils toward them. In a minute, maybe less, they will be able to see the riders throwing it, and, more important, the riders throwing it will be able to see them. Eamon Doolin says,
"You know, I believe we ought to get in that ditch." He points to the right side of the road, "and snay down small, small. Then, soon as they go by, we can jump out and have at 'em."
Molly Doolin is wearing tight black silk pants and a white silk blouse open at the throat to show a tiny silver reap charm, Oriza, with her fist raised. In her own right hand, Molly holds a sharpened dish, cool blue titanium steel, painted over with a delicate lacework of green spring rice. Slung over her shoulder is a reed pouch lined with silk. In it are 5 more plates, 2 of her own and 3 of her mother's. Her hair is so bright in the bright light that it looks as if her head is on fire. Soon enough, it will be burning, say true.
"You can do what you like, Eamon Doolin," she tells him. "As for me, I'm going to stand right here where they can see me, and shout my twin sister's name so they'll hear it plain. They may ride me down, but I'll kill one of them or cut the legs out from under one of their damn horses before they do. Of that much I'll be bound."
There's no time for more. The wolves come out of the dip that marks the entrance to Ara's little smallhold patch, and the 4 Kalafokan can see them at last, and there is no more talk of hiding. Jamie almost expected Eamon Doolin, who was mild-mannered and already losing his hair at 23, to drop his ba and go pelting into the high grass with his hands raised to show his surrender. Instead, he moves into place next to his wife and knocks a bolt. There is a low, whirring sound as he winds the cord tight, tight. They stand across the road with their boots in the flowery dust. They stand blocking the road. And what fills Jamie like a blessing is a sense of grace. This is the right thing to do. They're going to die here, but that's all right. Better to die than stand by while they take more children. Each one of them has lost a twin, and Pokey, who is by far the oldest of them, has lost both a brother and a young son to the wolves. This is right. They understand that the wolves may exact a toll of vengeance on the rest for the stand they're making, but it doesn't matter. This is right.
"Come on," Jamie shouts, and winds his own ba once and twice, then click. "Come on, ye buzzards, ye cowardy custards, come on and have some. Say Kala Bryn Sturgis."
There is a moment in the heat of the day when the wolves seem to draw no closer but only to shimmer in place. Then the sound of their horses' hooves, previously dull and muffled, grows sharp, and the wolves seem to leap forward through the swarming air. Their pants are as gray as the hides of their horses. Dark green cloaks flow out behind them. Green hoods surround masks—they must be masks—that turn the heads of the 4 remaining riders into the heads of snarling, hungry wolves.
4 again, 4, Jamie screams. 4 again, 4, even up, stand your ground, cullies, never run a step.
The 4 wolves sweep toward them on their gray horses. The men raise their baas. Molly, sometimes called Red Molly for her famous temper even more than her hair, raises her dish over her left shoulder. She looks not angry now, but cool and calm. The 2 wolves on the end have light sticks. They raise them. The 2 in the middle draw back their fists, which are clad in green gloves, to throw something. Sneetches, Jamie thinks coldly. That's what them are.
Hold, boys, Pokey says. Hold! Hold! Now!
He lets fly with a twang, and Jamie sees Pokey's bob bolt pass just over the head of the wolf second to the right. Emmons strikes the neck of the horse on the far left. The beast gives a crazy, whinnying cry and staggers just as the wolves begin to close the final 40 yards of distance. It crashes into its neighbor horse just as that second horse's rider throws the thing in his hand. It is indeed one of the Sneetches, but it sails far off course, and none of its guidance systems can lock onto anything. Jamie's bolt strikes the chest of the third rider. Jamie begins a scream of triumph that dies in dismay before it ever gets out of his throat. The bolt bounces off the thing's chest just as it would have bounced off Andy's, or a stone in the son-of-a-bitch field. Wearing armor. Oh, you buggardly thing. You're wearing armor under that twice-damned— The other Sneetch flies true, striking Eamon Doolin square in the face. His head explodes in a spray of blood and bone and mealy gray stuff. The Sneetch flies on, maybe 30 grop, then whirls and comes back. Jamie ducks and hears it flash over his head, giving off a low, hard hum as it flies. Molly has never moved, not even when she is showered with her husband's blood and brains. Now she screams, "This is for Minnie, you sons of whores," and throws her plate. The distance is very short by now, hardly any distance at all, but she throws it hard, and the plate rises as soon as it leaves her hand. "Too hard, dear," Jamie thinks as he ducks the swipe of a lightstick. The lightstick is also giving off that hard, savage buzz. "Too hard, you bugger!" But the wolf at which Molly has aimed actually rides into the rising dish. It strikes at just the point where the thing's green hood crosses the wolf mask it wears. There is an odd, muffled sound, chump, and the thing falls backward off its horse with its green gauntleted hands flying up. Pokey and Jamie raise a wild cheer, but Molly just reaches coolly into her pouch for another dish, all of them nestled neatly in there with the blunt gripping arcs pointed up. She is pulling it out when one of the light sticks cuts the arm off her body. She staggers, teeth peeling back from her lips in a snarl, and goes to one knee as her blouse bursts into flame. Jamie is amazed to see that she is reaching for the plate in her severed hand as it lies in the dust of the road. The three remaining wolves are past them. The one Molly caught with her dish lies in the dust, jerking crazily, those gauntleted hands flying up and down into the sky as if it's trying to say, "What can you do? What can you do with these damned sodbusters?" The other three wheel their mounts as neatly as a drilled team of cavalry soldiers and race back toward them. Molly pries the dish from her own dead fingers, then falls backward, engulfed in fire. "Stand, Pokey!" Jamie cries hysterically as their death rushes toward them under the burning steel sky. "Stand, goddamn you!" And still that feeling of grace as he smells the charring flesh of the Doolins. This is what they should have done all along, aye, all of them. For the wolves can be brought down, although they'll probably not live to tell, and these will take their dead compadre with them, so none will know. There's a twang as Pokey fires another bolt, and then a Sneetch strikes him dead center, and he explodes inside his clothes, belching blood and torn flesh from his sleeves, his cuffs from the busted buttons of his fly. Again Jamie is drenched, this time by the hot stew that was his friend. He fires his own ba and sees it groove the side of a gray horse. He knows it's useless to duck, but he ducks anyway, and something whirs over his head. One of the horses strikes him hard as it passes, knocking him into the ditch where Eamon proposed they hide. His ba flies from his hand. He lies there, open-eyed, not moving, knowing as they wheel their horses around again that there is nothing for it now but to play dead and hope they pass him by. They won't. Of course they won't. But it's the only thing to do, and so he does it, trying to give his eyes the glaze of death. In another few seconds, he knows he won't have to pretend. He smells dust, he hears the crickets in the grass, and he holds on to these things, knowing they are the last things he will ever smell and hear, that the last thing he sees will be the wolves, bearing down on him with their frozen snarls. They come pounding back.
One of them turns in its saddle and throws a sneech from its gloved hand as it passes. But as it throws, the rider's horse leaps the body of the downed wolf, which still lies twitching in the road, although now its hands barely rise. The sneech flies above Jamie, just a little too high. He can almost feel it hesitate, searching for prey. Then it soars on, out over the field. The wolves ride east, pulling dust behind them. The sneech doubles back and flies over Jamie again, this time higher and slower. The gray horses sweep around a curve in the road 50 yards east and are lost to view. The last he sees of them are three green cloaks, pulled out almost straight and fluttering. Jamie stands up in the ditch on legs that threaten to buckle beneath him. The sneech makes another loop and comes back, this time directly toward him, but now it is moving slowly, as if whatever powers it is almost exhausted. Jamie scrambles back into the road, falls to his knees next to the burning remains of Pokey's body, and seizes his ba. This time he holds it by the end as one might hold a points mallet. The sneech cruises toward him, Jamie draws the ba to his shoulder, and when the thing comes at him, he bats it out of the air as if it were a giant bug. It falls into the dust beside one of Pokey's torn-off shore boots, and lies there, buzzing malevolently, trying to rise. "There, you bastard!" Jamie screams, and begins to scoop dust over the thing. He's weeping. "There, you bastard! There! There!" At last it's gone, buried under a heap of white dust that buzzes and shakes, and at last becomes still. Without rising, he doesn't have the strength to find his feet again, not yet, can still hardly believe he's alive. Jamie Jaffords knee-walks toward the monster Molly has killed. And it is dead now, or at least lying still. He wants to pull off its mask, see it plain. First he kicks at it with both feet, like a child doing a tantrum. The wolf's body rocks from side to side, then lies still again. A pungent, reeky smell is coming from it. A rotten-smelling smoke is rising from the mask, which appears to be melting. Dead, thinks the boy who will eventually become grandpere, the oldest living human in the collar. Dead, aye. Never doubt it. So garn, ye gutless. Garn and unmask it. He does. Under the burning autumn sun he takes hold of the rotting mask, which feels like some sort of metal mesh, and he pulls it off, and he sees... 8. For a moment Eddie wasn't even aware that the old guy had stopped talking. He was still lost in the story, mesmerized. He saw everything so clearly. It could have been him out there on the east road, kneeling in the dust, with the ba cocked to his shoulder like a baseball bat, ready to knock the oncoming sneech out of the air. Then Susanna rolled past the porch toward the barn with a bowl of chicken feet in her lap. She gave them a curious look on her way by. Eddie woke up. He hadn't come here to be entertained. He supposed the fact that he could be entertained by such a story said something about him.
And? Eddie asked the old man when Susanna had gone into the barn. What did you see?
Eh?
Grandpère gave him a look of such perfect vacuity that Eddie despaired.
What did you see when you took off the mask?
For a moment, that look of emptiness, the lights are on but no one's home, held. And then, by pure force of will, it seemed to Eddie, the old man came back. He looked behind him at the house. He looked toward the black maw of the barn and the lick of phosphor light deep inside. He looked around the yard itself. Frightened, Eddie thought. Scared to death. Eddie tried to tell himself this was only an old man's paranoia, but he felt a chill all the same.
Lean close,
Grandpère muttered, and when Eddie did,
the only one I ever told was my boy, Luke. Tien's da, do you ken? Years and years later, this was. He told me never to speak of it to anyone else. I said, but Lukey, what if it could help? What if it could help to next time they come?
Grandpère's lips barely moved, but his thick accent had almost entirely departed, and Eddie could understand him perfectly.
and he said to me, "Da, if you really believed no one could help, why have you not told afore now?" And I couldn't answer him, young fella, 'cause 'twas nothing but intuition kept my gob shut. Besides, what good could it do? What do it change?
"I don't know," Eddie said. Their faces were close. Eddie could smell beef and gravy on old Jamie's breath. "How can I when you haven't told me what you saw?"
"The Red King always finds his henchmen," my boy said. "It'd be good if no one ever knew you were out there, better still if no one ever heard what you saw out there, lest it get back to him, aye, even in Thunderclap. And I seen a sad thing, young fellow."
Although he was almost wild with impatience, Eddie thought it best to let the old guy unwind it in his own way.
"What was that, Grandpère?"
"I seen Luke didn't entirely believe me. Thought his own da might just be a story and telling a wild tale about being a wolf-killer to look tall. Although you'd think even a half-wit would see that if I was going to make a tale, I'd make it me that killed the wolf, and not Eamon Doolin's wife."
That made sense, Eddie thought, and then remembered Grandpère at least hinting that he had taken credit more than once upon a, as Roland sometimes said. He smiled in spite of himself.
"Lookie were afraid someone else might hear my story and believe it, that it'd get on to the wolves, and I might end up dead for no more than telling a make-believe story. Not that it were."
His roomy old eyes begged at Eddie's face in the growing dark.
"You believe me, don't you?"
Eddie nodded. "I know you say true, Grandpère. But who—" Eddie paused. "Who would rat you out?" was how the question came to mind, but Grandpère might not understand. "But who would tell? Who did you suspect?" Grandpère looked around the darkening yard, seemed about to speak, then said nothing. "Tell me," Eddie said. "Tell me what you—" A large, dry hand, a tremor with age but still amazingly strong, gripped his neck and pulled him close. Bristly whiskers rasped against the shell of Eddie's ear, making him shudder all over and break out in goose flesh. Grandpère whispered 19 words as the last light died out of the day and night came to the collar. Eddie Dean's eyes widened. His first thought was that he now understood about the horses, all the gray horses. His second was, "Of course. It makes perfect sense. We should have known." The 19th word was spoken, and Grandpère's whisper ceased. The hand gripping Eddie's neck dropped back into Grandpère's lap. Eddie turned to face him. "Say true?"
"Aye, gunslinger," said the old man. "True as ever was. I canna say for all of them, for many similar masks may cover many different faces, but—"
"No," Eddie said, thinking of gray horses, not to mention all those sets of gray pants, all those green cloaks. It made perfect sense. What was that old song his mother used to sing? "You're in the army now, you're not behind the plow, you'll never get rich, you son of a bitch, you're in the army now." "I'll have to tell this story to my Dan," Eddie said. Grandpère nodded slowly.
"Aye," he said, "as you will. I don't get along well with the boy, you ken it. Look, he tried to put to well where Tien pointed with the drotter stick, you ken."
Eddie nodded, as if he understood this. Later, Susanna translated it for him. "I don't get along well with the boy, you understand. Lukey tried to put the well where Tien pointed with the dowsing stick, you see." "A dowser?" Susanna asked from out of the darkness. She had returned quietly and now gestured with her hands as if holding a wishbone. The old man looked at her surprised, then nodded.
"The drotter, yeah. Anyro, I argued again it, but after the wolves came and took his sister, Tia, Lukey done whatever the boy wanted. Can you imagine letting a boy no more'n 17 sight the well, drotter or no? but look, he put it there and there were water. I'll give you that. We all seen it gleam and smelt it before the clay sides give down and buried my boy alive. We dug him out, but he were gone to the clearing, throat and lungs all full of clay and muck.
Slowly, slowly, the old man took a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his eyes with it.
The boy and I ain't had a civil word between us since. That well's dug between us, do you not see it? But he's right about wanting to stand again the wolves. And if you tell him anything for me, tell him his grandpere salutes him damn proud, salutes him big, big, yer bugger. He got the sand of Jaffords in his craw. Aye, we stood our stand all those years agone, and now the blood shows true.
He nodded, this time even more slowly.
Go on and tell your den, aye, every word. And if it seeps out, if the wolves were to come out of Thunderclap early for one dried-up old turd like me.
He bared his few remaining teeth in a smile that he found extraordinarily gruesome.
"I can still wind a bar," he said. "And something tells me your brownie could be taught to throw a dish, sure legs or no."
The old man looked off into the darkness.
"Let him come," he said softly. "Last time pays for all, you're a bugger. Last time pays for all."
Chapter 7 Nocturne Hunger 1 Mia was in the castle again, but this time was different. This time she did not move slowly, toying with her hunger, knowing that soon it would be fed and fed completely, that both she and her chap would be satisfied. This time what she felt inside was ravenous desperation, as if some wild animal had been caged up inside her belly. She understood that what she had felt on all those previous expeditions hadn't been hunger at all, not true hunger, but only healthy appetite. This was different.
"His time is coming," she thought. "He needs to eat more in order to get his strength, and so do I."
Yet she was afraid, she was terrified, that it wasn't just a matter of needing to eat more. There was something she needed to eat, something for special. The chap needed it in order to
finish the becoming. Yes. Yes, that was it, the becoming. And surely she would find it in the banquet hall, because everything was in the banquet hall. 1,000 dishes, each more succulent than the last. She would graze the table, and when she found the right thing, the right vegetable or spice or meat or fish roe, her guts and nerves would cry out for it, and she would eat. Oh, she would gobble. She began to hurry along faster yet, and then to run. She was vaguely aware that her legs were swishing together because she was wearing pants, denim pants, like a cowboy. And instead of slippers, she was wearing boots. "Shore boots," her mind whispered to her mind. "Shore boots, may they do you fine." But none of this mattered. What mattered was eating, gorging, oh, she was so hungry, and finding the right thing for the chap, finding the thing that would both make him strong and bring on her labor. She pelted down the broad staircase into the steady beating murmur of the slow trans engines. Wonderful smells should have overwhelmed her by now, roasted meats, barbecued poultry, herbed fish, but she couldn't smell food at all. "Maybe I have a cold," she thought, as her shore boots stut-tut-tutted on the stairs. "That must be it. I must have a cold. My sinuses are all swollen, and I can't smell anything." But she could. She could smell the dust and age of this place. She could smell damp seepage and the faint tang of engine oil and the mildew eating relentlessly into tapestries and curtains hung in the rooms of ruin. Those things. But no food. She dashed along the black marble floor toward the double doors, unaware that she was again being followed. Not by the gunslinger this time, but by a wide-eyed, tousle-haired boy in a cotton shirt and a pair of cotton shorts. Mia crossed the foyer with its red and black marble squares and the statue of smoothly entwined marble and steel. She didn't stop to curtsy or even nod her head. That she should be so hungry was bearable, but not her chap, never her chap. What halted her, and only for a space of seconds, was her own reflection, milky and irresolute, in the statue's chrome steel. Above her jeans was a plain white shirt, you call this kind a T-shirt, her mind whispered, with some writing on it and a picture. The picture appeared to be of a pig. Never mind what's on your shirt, woman. The chap's what matters. You must feed the chap. She burst into the dining hall and stopped with a gasp of dismay. The room was full of shadows now. A few of the electric torches still glowed, but most had gone out. As she looked, the only one still burning at the far end of the room stuttered, buzzed, and fell dark. The white for special plates had been replaced with blue ones decorated with green tendrils of rice. The rice plants formed the great letter Z sub N, which, she knew, meant eternity, and now, and also come, as in come Kamala. But plates didn't matter, decorations didn't matter. What mattered was that the plates and beautiful crystal glassware were empty and dull with dust. No, not everything was empty. In one goblet she saw a dead black widow spider lying with its many legs curled against the red hourglass on its midsection. She saw the neck of a wine bottle poking from a silver pail, and her stomach gave an imperative cry. She snatched it up, barely registering the fact that there was no water in the bucket, let alone ice. It was entirely dry. At least the bottle had weight and enough liquid inside to slosh, but before Mia could close her lips over the neck of the bottle, the smell of vinegar smote her so strongly that her eyes filled with water. "Motherfuck!" she screamed and threw the bottle down. "You motherfucker!" The bottle shattered on the stone floor. Things ran in, squeaking surprise beneath the table. "Yeah, you better run," she screamed. "Get your gun, whatever you are. Here's me, a daughter of none, and not in a good mood, yet I will be fed. Yes, yes, I will." This was bold talk, but at first she saw nothing on the table that she could eat. There was bread, but the one piece she bothered to pick up had turned to stone. There was what appeared to be the remains of a fish, but it had putrefied and lay in a greenish-white simmer of maggots. Her stomach growled, undeterred by this mess. Worse, something below her stomach turned restlessly and kicked and cried out to be fed. It did this not with its voice, but by turning certain switches inside her, back in the most primitive sections of her nervous system. Her throat grew dry, her mouth puckered as if she had drunk the turned wine. Her vision sharpened as her eyes widened and bulged outward in their sockets, every thought, every sense, and every instinct tuned to the same simple idea, food. Beyond the far end of the table was a screen showing Arthur Eld, sword held high, riding through a swamp with three of his knight gunslingers behind him. Around his neck was Saita, the great snake, which presumably he had just slain. Another successful quest, do you find, men and their quests. Bah, what was slaying a magical snake to her? She had a chap in her belly, and the chap was hungry. Hungry, she thought in a voice that wasn't her own. It's be hungry. Behind the screen were double doors. She shoved through them, still unaware of the boy Jake standing at the far end of the dining hall in his underwear, looking at her, afraid. The kitchen was likewise empty, likewise dusty. The counters were tattooed with critter tracks. Pots and pans and cooking racks were jumbled across the floor. Beyond this litter were four sinks, one filled with stagnant water that had grown a scum of algae. The room was lit by fluorescent tubes, only a few still glowed slightly. Most of them flickered on and off, giving these shambles a surreal and nightmarish aspect. She worked her way across the kitchen, kicking aside the pots and pans that were in her way. Here stood four huge ovens all around. The door of the third was ajar. From it came a faint shimmer of heat as one might feel coming from a hearth 6 or 8 hours after the last embers have burned out, and a smell that set her stomach clamoring all over again. It was the smell of freshly roasted meat. Mia opened the door. Inside was indeed some sort of roast. Feeding on it was a rat the size of a tomcat. It turned its head at the clunk of the opening oven door and looked at her with black, fearless eyes. Its whiskers, bleary with grease, twitched, then it turned back to the roast. She could hear the muttering smack of its lips and the sound of tearing flesh.
"Nay, Mr. Rat, it wasn't left for you. It was left for me and my chap."
"One chance, my friend," she sang as she turned toward the counters and storage cabinets beneath them. "Better go while you can, fair warning."
Not that it would Mr. Rat be hungry, too. She opened a drawer and found nothing but breadboards and a rolling pin. She considered the rolling pin briefly, but had no wish to baste her dinner with more rat blood than she absolutely had to. She opened the cabinet beneath and found tins for muffins and molds for fancy desserts. She moved to her left, opened another drawer, and here was what she was looking for. Mia considered the knives. Took one of the meat forks instead. It had 2 6-inch steel tines. She took it back to the row of ovens, hesitated, and checked the other three. They were empty, as she had known they would be. Something, some fate, some providence, some ka, had left fresh meat, but only enough for one. Mr. Rat thought it was his. Mr. Rat had made a mistake. She did not think he would make another, not this side of the clearing anyway. She bent, and once again the smell of freshly cooked pork filled her nose. Her lips spread, and drool ran from the corners of her smile. This time Mr. Rat didn't look around. Mr. Rat had decided she was no threat. That was all right. She bent further forward, drew a breath, and impaled it on the meat fork. Rat kebab! She drew it out and held it up in front of her face. It squealed furiously, its legs spinning in the air, its head lashing back and forth, blood running down the meat fork's handle to pool around her fist. She carried it, still writhing, to the sink full of stagnant water and flipped it off the fork. It splashed into the murk and disappeared. For a moment, the tip of its twitching tail stuck up, and then that was gone too. She went down the line of sinks, trying the faucets, and from the last one got a feeble trickle of water. She rinsed her bloody hand under it until the trickle subsided. Then she walked back to the oven, wiping her hand dry on the seat of her breeches. She did not see Jake, now standing just inside the kitchen doors and watching her, although he made no attempt to hide. She was totally fixated on the smell of the meat. It wasn't enough, and not precisely what her chap needed, but it would do for the time being. She reached in, grasped the sides of the roasting pan, then pulled back with a gasp, shaking her fingers and grinning. It was a grin of pain, yet not entirely devoid of humor. Mr. Rat had either been a trifle more immune to the heat than she was, or maybe hungrier. Although it was hard to believe anyone or anything could be hungrier than she was right now.
"Eyes hungry," she yelled, laughing as she went down the line of drawers, opening and closing them swiftly. "Mia's one hungry lady, yes, sir. Didn't go to Moore House, didn't go to no house, but eyes hungry, and my chap's hungry, too."
In the last drawer, wasn't that always the way, she found the hot pads she'd been looking for. She hurried back to the oven with them in her hands, bent down, and pulled the roast out. Her laughter died in a sudden, shocked gasp, and then burst out again louder and stronger than ever. What a goose she was! What a damned silly billy! For one instant, she'd thought the roast, which had been done to a skin-crackling turn and only gnawed by Mr. Rat in one place, was the body of a child. And yes, she supposed that a roasted pig did look a little bit like a child, a baby, someone's chap. But now that it was out and she could see the closed eyes and the charred ears and the baked apple in the open mouth, there was no question about what it was. As she set it on the counter, she thought again about the reflection she'd seen in the foyer. But never mind that now. Her gut was a roar of famishment. She plucked a butcher's knife out of the drawer from which she had taken the meat fork and cut off the place where Mr. Rat had been eating the way you'd cut a wormhole out of an apple. She tossed this piece back over her shoulder, then picked up the roast entire and buried her face in it. From the door, Jake watched her. When the keenest edge had been taken off her hunger, Mia looked around the kitchen with an expression that wavered between calculation and despair. What was she supposed to do when the roast was gone? What was she supposed to eat the next time this sort of hunger came? And where was she supposed to find what her chap really wanted, really needed?
She'd do anything to locate that stuff and secure a good supply of it, that special food or drink or vitamin or whatever it was. The pork was close. Close enough to put him to sleep again, thank all the gods and the man Jesus, but not close enough. She banged Cy Piggy back into the roasting pan for the nonce, pulled the shirt she was wearing off over her head, and turned it so she could look at the front. There was a cartoon pig, roasted bright red but seeming not to mind. It was smiling blissfully. Above it, in rustic letters made to look like barn board, was this: The Dixie Pig, Lex and 61st. Below it, Best Ribs in New York, Gourmet Magazine. The Dixie Pig, she thought. The Dixie Pig. Where have I heard that before? She didn't know, but she believed she could find Lex if she had to. It'd be right there between Third and Park, she said. That's right, ain't it? The boy, who had slipped back out but left the door ajar, heard this and nodded miserably. That was where it was, all right. Well, oh well, Mia thought. It all does fine for now, good as it can do anyway. And like that woman in the book said, tomorrow's another day. Worry about it then. Right? Right. She picked up the roast again and began to eat. The smacking sounds she made were really not much different from those made by the rat. Really, not much different at all. 2. Tian and Zelia had tried to give Eddie and Susanna their bedroom, convincing them that their guests really didn't want their bedroom, that sleeping there would actually make them uncomfortable, hadn't been easy. It was Susanna who finally turned the trick, telling the Jaffordses in a hesitant, confiding voice that something awful had happened to them in the City of Lud, something so traumatic that neither of them could sleep easily in a house anymore. A barn, where you could see the door open to the outside world any time you wanted to take a look, was much better. It was a good tale and well told. Tian and Zelia listened with a sympathetic credulity that made Eddie feel guilty. A lot of bad things had happened to them in Lud, that much was true, but nothing which made either of them nervous about sleeping indoors. At least he guessed not. Since leaving their own world, the two of them had only spent a single night, the previous, under the actual roof of an actual house. Now he sat cross-legged on one of the blankets Zelia had given them to spread on the hay, the other two cast aside. He was looking out into the yard, past the porch where Grandpere had told his tale, and toward the river. The moon flitted in and out of the clouds, first brightening the scene to silver, then darkening it. Eddie hardly saw what he was looking at. His ears were trained on the floor of the barn below him, where the stalls and pens were. She was down there somewhere. He was sure she was. But God, she was so quiet. And by the way, who is she? Mia, Roland says, but that's just a name. Who is she, really? But it wasn't just a name. It means mother in the high speech, the gunslinger had said. It means mother. Yeah. But she's not the mother of my kid. The chap is not my son. A soft clunk from below him, followed by the creak of a board. Eddie stiffened. She was down there, all right. He'd begun to have his doubts, but she was. He had awakened, after perhaps 6 hours of deep and dreamless sleep, to discover she was gone. He went to the barn's bay door, which they'd left open, and looked out. There she was. Even by moonlight, he'd known that wasn't really Susanna down there in the wheelchair. Not his Suze, not Odetta Holmes, or Detta Walker either. Yet she wasn't entirely unfamiliar. She... You saw her in New York. Only then she had legs and she knew how to use them. She had legs, and she didn't want to go too close to the rose. She had her reasons for that, and they were good reasons. But you know what I think the real reason was? I think she was afraid it would hurt whatever it is she's carrying in her belly. Yet he felt sorry for the woman below. No matter who she was or what she was carrying, she'd gotten herself into the situation while saving Jake Chambers. She'd held off the demon of the circle, trapping it inside her just long enough for Eddie to finish whittling the key he'd made. If you'd finished it earlier, if you hadn't been such a damned little chicken shit, she might not even be in this mess. Did you ever think of that?
Eddie had pushed the thought away. There was some truth to it, of course. He had lost his confidence while whittling the key, which was why it hadn't been finished when the time of Jake's drawing came. But he was done with that kind of thinking. It was good for nothing but creating a truly excellent array of self-inflicted wounds. Whoever she was, his heart had gone out to the woman he saw below him. In the sleeping silence of the night, through the alternating shutters of moonlight and dark, she pushed Susanna's wheelchair first across the yard, then back, then across again, then left, then right. She reminded him a little of the old robots in Shardik's clearing, the ones Roland had made him shoot. And was that so surprising? He drifted off to sleep thinking of those robots, and what Roland had said of them. They are creatures of great sadness, I think, in their own way. Eddie is going to put them out of their misery. And so he had, after some persuasion. The one that looked like a many-jointed snake, the one that looked like the Tonka tractor he'd once gotten as a birthday present, the ill-tempered, stainless steel rat. He'd shot them all except for the last. Some sort of mechanical flying thing. Roland had gotten that one. Like the old robots, the woman in the yard below wanted to go someplace but didn't know where. She wanted to get something, but didn't know what. The question was, what was he supposed to do? Just watch and wait. Use the time to think up some other bullshit story in case one of them wakes up and sees her in the dooryard pacing around in her wheelchair. More post-traumatic stress syndrome from Lud, maybe. "Hey, it works for me," he murmured, but just then Susanna had turned and wheeled back toward the barn, now moving with a purpose. Eddie had lain down, prepared to feign sleep, but instead of hearing her coming upstairs, he had heard a faint cling, a grunt of effort, then the creak of boards going away toward the rear of the barn. In his mind's eye, he saw her getting out of her chair and heading back there at her usual speedy crawl. For what? 5 minutes of silence. He was just beginning to get really nervous when there was a single squeal, short and sharp. It was so much like the cry of an infant that his balls pulled up tight and his skin broke out in goose flesh. He looked toward the ladder leading down to the barn floor and made himself wait some more. That was a pig. One of the young ones. Just a shoat, that's all. Maybe. But what he kept picturing was the younger set of twins, especially the girl. Leah rhymes with Mia. No more than babies, and it was crazy to think of Susanna cutting a child's throat. Totally insane, but... But that's not Susanna down there, and if you start thinking it is, you're apt to get hurt, the way you almost got hurt before. Hurt, hell, almost killed was what he'd been. Almost gotten his face chewed off by the lobstrosities. It was Detta who threw me to the creepy crawlies. This one... Isn't her. Yes, and he had an idea, only an intuition, really, that this one might be a hell of a lot nicer than Detta, but he'd be a fool to bet his life on it. Or the lives of the children. Tien and Zalia's children. He sat there sweating, not knowing what to do. Now, after what seemed an interminable wait, there were more squeaks and creaks. The last came from directly beneath the ladder leading to the loft. Eddie lay back again and closed his eyes. Not quite all the way, though. Peering through his lashes, he saw her head appear above the loft floor. At that moment, the moon sailed out from behind a cloud and flooded the loft with light. He saw blood at the corners of her mouth, as dark as chocolate, and reminded himself to wipe it off her in the morning. He didn't want any of the Jafford clan seeing it. What I want to see is the twins, Eddie thought. Both sets, all four, alive and well. Especially Leah. What else do I want? For Tien to come out of the barn with a frown on his face. For him to ask us if we heard anything in the night, maybe a fox, or even one of those rock cats they talk about. Because, see, one of the shoats has gone missing. Hope you hid whatever was left of it, Mia, or whoever you are. Hope you hid it well. She came to him, lay down, turned over once and fell asleep. He could tell by the sound of her breathing. Eddie turned his head and looked toward the sleeping Jaffords' home place. She didn't go anywhere near the house.
No.
not unless she'd wheeled her chair all the way through the barn and right out the back, that was. Gone around that way, slipped in a window, taken one of the younger twins, taken the little girl, taken her back to the barn, and...
She didn't do that. Didn't have the time, for one thing. Maybe not, but he'd feel a lot better in the morning, just the same, when he saw all the kids at breakfast. Including Aaron, the little boy with the chubby legs and the little sticking-out belly. He thought of what his mother sometimes said when she saw a mother wheeling a little one like that along the street. So cute, looks good enough to eat.
Quit it, go to sleep.
But it was a long time before Eddie got back to sleep. 3. Jake awoke from his nightmare with a gasp, not sure where he was. He sat up, shivering, arms wrapped around himself. He was wearing nothing but a plain cotton shirt, too big for him, and flimsy cotton shorts, sort of like gym shorts, that were also too big for him.
What?
There was a grunt, followed by a muffled fart. Jake looked toward these sounds, saw Benny Sleitman buried up to the eyes under two blankets, and everything fell into place. He was wearing one of Benny's undershirts and a pair of Benny's undershorts. They were in Benny's tent. They were on the bluff overlooking the river. The river banks out here were stony, Benny had said, no good for rice, but plenty good for fishing. If they were just a little bit lucky, they'd be able to catch their own breakfast out of the Divartiti Huay. And although Benny knew Jake and Oi would have to return to the old fellow's house to be with their din and their ka mates for a day or two, maybe longer, perhaps Jake could come back later on. There was good fishing here, good swimming a little way upstream, and caves where the walls glowed in the dark and the lizards glowed too. Jake had gone to sleep well satisfied by the prospect of these wonders. He wasn't crazy about being out here without a gun. He had seen too much and done too much to ever feel entirely comfortable without a gun these days. But he was pretty sure Andy was keeping an eye on them, and he'd allowed himself to sleep deep. Then the dream, the horrible dream. Susanna in the huge, dirty kitchen of an abandoned castle. Susanna holding up a squirming rat impaled on a meat fork. Holding it up and laughing while blood ran down the fork's wooden handle and pooled around her hand. That was no dream, and you know it. You have to tell Roland. The thought which followed this was somehow even more disturbing. Roland already knows. So does Eddie. Jake sat with his knees against his chest and his arms linked around his shins, feeling more miserable than at any time since getting a good look at his final essay in Miss Avery's English comp class. My Understanding of the Truth, it had been called, and although he understood it a lot better now, understood how much of it must have been called forth by what Roland called the touch, his first reaction had been pure horror. What he felt now wasn't so much horror as it was, well, sadness, he thought. Yes, they were supposed to be quartet, one from many, but now their unity had been lost. Susanna had become another person, and Roland didn't want her to know, not with wolves on the way both here and in the other world. Wolves of the Kala, wolves of New York. He wanted to be angry, but there seemed no one to be angry at. Susanna had gotten pregnant helping him, after all, and if Roland and Eddie weren't telling her stuff, it was because they wanted to protect her. Yeah, right, a resentful voice spoke up. They also want to make sure she's able to help out when the wolves come riding out of Thunderclap. It'd be one less gun if she was busy having a miscarriage or a nervous breakdown or something. He knew that wasn't fair, but the dream had shaken him badly. The rat was what he kept coming back to, that rat writhing on the meat fork. Her holding it up and grinning. Don't want to forget that, grinning. He'd touched the thought in her mind at that moment. And the thought had been rat kebab. Christ, he whispered. He guessed he understood why Roland wasn't telling Susanna about Mia and about the baby, what Mia called the chap, but didn't the gunslinger understand that something far more important had been lost, and was getting more lost every day this was allowed to go on? They know better than you. They're grown-ups. Jake thought that was bullshit. If being a grown-up really meant knowing better, why did his father go on smoking 3 packs of unfiltered cigarettes a day and snorting cocaine until his nose bled? If being a grown-up gave you some sort of special knowledge of the right things to do, how come his mother was sleeping with her masseuse, who had huge biceps and no brains? Why had neither of them noticed, as the spring of 1977 marched toward summer, that their kid, who had a nickname, Bama, known only to the housekeeper, was losing his fucking mind? This isn't the same thing. But what if it was? What if Roland and Eddie were so close to the problem they couldn't see the truth? What is the truth? What is your understanding of the truth? That they were no longer quartet. That was his understanding of the truth. What was it Roland had said to Callahan at that first palaver? We are round and roll as we do. That had been true then, but Jake didn't think it was true now. He remembered an old joke people told when they got a blowout. Well, it's only flat on the bottom. That was them now. Flat on the bottom. No longer truly quartet. How could they be when they were keeping secrets? And was Mia and the child growing in Susanna's stomach the only secret? Jake thought not. There was something else as well, something Roland was keeping back, not just from Susanna, but from all of them. We can beat the wolves if we're together, he thought. If we're quartet. But not the way we are now. Not over here, not in New York either. I just don't believe it. Another thought came on the heels of that, one so terrible he first tried to push it away. Only he couldn't do that, he realized. Little as he wanted to, this was an idea that had to be considered. I could take matters into my own hands. I could tell her myself. And then what? What would he tell Roland? How would he explain? I couldn't. There'd be no explanation I could make or that he'd listen to. The only thing I could do... He remembered Roland's story of the day he'd stood against court. The battered old squireen with his stick, the untried boy with his hawk. If he, Jake, were to go against Roland's decision and tell Susanna what had so far been held back from her, it would lead directly to his own manhood test. And I'm not ready. Maybe Roland was, barely, but I'm not him. Nobody is. He'd best me, and I'd be sent east into Thunderclap alone. Oi would try to come with me, but I couldn't let him, because it's death over there. Maybe for our whole quartet, surely for a kid all by himself. And yet still the secrets Roland was keeping, that was wrong. And so, they'd be together again, all of them, to hear the rest of Callahan's story, and maybe to deal with the thing in Callahan's church. What should he do then? Talk to him. Try to persuade him he's doing the wrong thing. All right, he could do that. It would be hard, but he could do it. Should he talk to Eddie as well? Jake thought not. Adding Eddie would complicate things even more. Let Roland decide what to tell Eddie. Roland, after all, was the dean. The flap of the tent shivered, and Jake's hand went to his side, where the Ruger would have hung if he had been wearing the Docker's clutch. Not there, of course, but this time that was all right. It was only Oi poking his snout under the flap and tossing it up so he could get his head into the tent. Jake reached out to pat the bumbler's head. Oi seized his hand gently in his teeth and tugged. Jake went with him willingly enough. He felt as if sleep were 1,000 miles away. Outside the tent, the world was a study in severe blacks and whites. A rock-studded slope led down to the river, which was broad and shallow at this point. The moon burned in it like a lamp. Jake saw 2 figures down there on the rocky strand and froze. As he did, the moon went behind a cloud and the world darkened. Oi's jaws closed on his hand again and pulled him forward. Jake went with him, found a 4-foot drop, and eased himself down. Oi now stood above and just behind him, panting into his ear like a little engine. The moon came out from behind its cloud. The world brightened again. Jake saw Oi had led him to a large chunk of granite that came jutting out of the earth like the prow of a buried ship. It was a good hiding place. He peered around it and down at the river. There was no doubt about one of them. Its height and the moonlight gleaming on metal were enough to identify Andy, the messenger robot, many other functions. The other one, though. Who was the other one? Jake squinted, but at first couldn't tell. It was at least 200 yards from his hiding place to the riverbank below, and although the moonlight was brilliant, it was also tricky. The man's face was raised so he could look at Andy, and the moonlight fell squarely on him, but the features seemed to swim. Only the hat the guy was wearing. He knew the hat. You could be wrong. Then the man turned his head slightly. The moonlight sent twin glints back from his face, and Jake knew for sure. There might be lots of cowpokes in the Kala who wore round-crowned hats like the one yonder, but Jake had only seen a single guy so far who wore spectacles. Okay, it's Benny's Da, what of it? Not all parents are like mine. Some of them get worried about their kids, especially if they've already lost one the way Mr. Sleitman lost Benny's twin sister. To hot lung, Benny said, which probably means pneumonia. 6 years ago. So we come out here camping, and Mr. Sleitman sends Andy to keep an eye on us, only then he wakes up in the middle of the night and decides to check on us for himself. Maybe he had his own bad dream. Maybe so. But that didn't explain why Andy and Mr. Sleitman were having their palaver way down there by the river, did it? Well, maybe he was afraid of waking us up. Maybe he'll come up to check on the tent now, in which case I better get back inside it. Or maybe he'll take Andy's word that we're all right and head back to the Rocking Bee. The moon went behind another cloud, and Jake thought it best to stay where he was until it came back out. When it did, what he saw filled him with the same sort of dismay he'd felt in his dream following Mia through that deserted castle. For a moment he clutched at the possibility that this was a dream, that he'd simply gone from one to another. But the feel of the pebbles biting into his feet and the sound of Oi panting in his ear were completely undreamlike. This was happening, all right. Mr. Sleitman wasn't coming up toward where the boys had pitched their tent, and he wasn't heading back toward the Rocking Bee either, although Andy was, in long strides along the bank. No, Benny's father was wading across the river. He was heading dead east. He could have a reason for going over there. He could have a perfectly good reason. Really? What might that perfectly good reason be? It wasn't the Kala anymore over there, Jake knew that much. Over there was nothing but waste ground and desert, a buffer between the borderlands and the kingdom of the dead that was Thunderclap. First something wrong with Susanna, his friend Susanna, now it seemed something wrong with the father of his new friend. Jake realized he had begun to gnaw at his nails, a habit he'd picked up in his final weeks at Piper School, and made himself stop. "This isn't fair, you know," he said to Oi. "This isn't fair at all." Oi licked his ear. Jake turned, put his arms around the bumbler, and pressed his face against his friend's lush coat. The bumbler stood patiently, allowing this. After a little while, Jake pulled himself back up to the more level ground where Oi stood. He felt a little better, a little comforted. The moon went behind another cloud, and the world darkened. Jake stood where he was. Oi whined softly. "Just a minute," Jake murmured. The moon came out again. Jake looked hard at the place where Andy and Ben Sleitman had palavered, marking it in his memory. There was a large round rock with a shiny surface. A dead log had washed up against it. Jake was pretty sure he could find the spot again, even if Benny's tent was gone. "Are you going to tell Roland?" "I don't know," he muttered.
"No,"
Oi said from beside his ankle, making Jake jump a little. Or was it N-O? Was that what the bumbler had actually said? "Are you crazy?" He wasn't. There was a time when he'd thought he was crazy, crazy or going there in one hell of a hurry, but he didn't think that anymore. And sometimes Oi did read his mind, he knew it. Jake slipped back into the tent. Then he was still fast asleep. Jake looked at the other boy, older in years but younger in a lot of the ways that mattered, for several seconds, biting his lip. He didn't want to get Benny's father in trouble, not unless he had to. Jake lay down and pulled his blankets up to his chin. He had never in his life felt so undecided about so many things. And he wanted to cry, The day had begun to grow light before he was able to get back to sleep. Chapter 8. Took's Store, The Unfound Door. 1. For the first half hour after leaving the Rocking Bee, Roland and Jake rode east toward the small holds in silence, their horses ambling side by side in perfect good fellowship. Roland knew Jake had something serious on his mind that was clear from his troubled face. Yet the gunslinger was still astounded when Jake curled his fist, placed it against the left side of his chest, and said, "Roland, before Eddie and Susanna join up with us, may I speak to you, Dan Dean?" "May I open my heart to your command?" But the subtext was more complicated than that, and ancient, predating Arthur Eld by centuries, or so Vanet had claimed. It meant to turn some insoluble emotional problem, usually having to do with a love affair, over to one's Din. When one did this, he or she agreed to do exactly as the Din suggested, immediately and without question. But surely Jake Chambers didn't have love problems. Not unless he'd fallen for the gorgeous Francine Tavery, that was, and how had he known such a phrase in the first place? Meanwhile, Jake was looking at him with a wide-eyed, pale-cheeked solemnity that Roland didn't much like.
"Dan Din. What did you hear that, Jake?"
"Never did. Picked it up from your mind, I think," Jake added hastily. "I don't go snooping in there, or anything like that, but sometimes stuff just comes. Most of it isn't very important, I don't think, but sometimes there are phrases."
"You pick them up like a crow or a rusty picks up the bright things that catch its eye from the wing."
"I guess so, yeah."
"What others? Tell me a few."
Jake looked embarrassed. "I can't remember many. Dan Din, that means I open my heart to you and agree to do what you say." It was more complicated than that, but the boy had caught the essence. Roland nodded. The sun felt good on his face as they clopped along. Margaret Eisenhart's exhibition with the plate had soothed him. He'd had a good meeting with the lady-sized father later on, and he had slept quite well for the first time in many nights.
"Yes."
"Let's see, there's telemy, which means, I think, to gossip about someone you shouldn't gossip about. It stuck in my head because that's what gossip sounds like, telemy." Jake cupped a hand to his ear. Roland smiled. It was actually telemy, but Jake had, of course, picked it up phonetically. This was really quite amazing. He reminded himself to guard his deep thoughts carefully in the future. There were ways that could be done, thank the gods. "There's Dash Din, which means some sort of religious leader. You're thinking about that this morning, I think, because of... Is it because of the old Manny guy? Is he a Dash Din?" Roland nodded.
"Very much so. And his name, Jake?"
The gunslinger concentrated on it.
"Can you see his name in my mind?"
"Sure, Henchik," Jake said at once, and almost offhandedly. "You talked to him, when, late last night?"
"Yes."
That he hadn't been concentrating on, and he would have felt better had Jake not known of it. But the boy was strong in the touch, and Roland believed him when he said he hadn't been snooping. At least not on purpose. "Mrs. Eisenhart thinks she hates him, but you think she's only afraid of him."
"Yes,"
Roland said.
"You're strong in the touch. Much more so than Alain ever was, and much more than you were. It's because of the rose, isn't it?"
Jake nodded. "The rose, yes." They rode in silence a little longer, their horses' hooves raising a thin dust. In spite of the sun, the day was chilly, promising real fall.
"All right, Jake. Speak to me, Dan Din, if you would, and I say thanks for your trust in such wisdom as I have."
But for the space of almost 2 minutes, Jake said nothing. Roland pried at him, trying to get inside the boy's head as the boy had gotten inside his, and with such ease. But there was nothing. Nothing at all. But there was. There was a rat. Squirming. Impaled on something. "Where is the castle she goes to?" Jake asked. "Do you know?" Roland was unable to conceal his surprise, his astonishment, really. and he supposed there was an element of guilt there as well. Suddenly he understood, well, not everything, but much.
"There is no castle, and never was,"
he told Jake.
"It's a place she goes to in her mind, probably made up of the stories she's read and the ones I've told by the campfire as well. She goes there so she won't have to see what she's really eating, what her baby needs."
"I saw her eating a roasted pig," Jake said. "Only before she came, a rat was eating it. She stabbed it with a meat fork."
"Where did you see this?"
"In the castle." He paused. "In her dream. I was in her dream."
"Did she see you there?"
The gunslinger's blue eyes were sharp, almost blazing. His horse clearly felt some change, for it stopped, so did Jake's. Here they were on East Road, less than a mile from where Red Molly Doolin had once killed a wolf out of Thunderclap. Here they were, facing each other. "No," Jake said, "she didn't see me." Roland was thinking of the night he had followed her into the swamp. He had known she was someplace else in her mind, had sensed that much, but not quite where. Whatever visions he'd taken from her mind had been murky. Now he knew. He knew something else as well. Jake was troubled by his Din's decision to let Susanna go on this way. And perhaps he was right to be troubled, but...
"It's not Susanna you saw, Jake."
"I know. It's the one who still has her legs. She calls herself Mia. She's pregnant, and she's scared to death." Roland said,
"If you would speak to me, Dan Din, tell me everything you saw in your dream and everything that troubled you about it upon waking. Then I'll give you the wisdom of my heart, such wisdom as I have."
"You won't, Roland, you won't scold me?" This time Roland was unable to conceal his astonishment.
"No, Jake, far from it. Perhaps I should ask you not to scold me."
The boy smiled wanly. The horses began to amble again, this time a little faster, as if they knew there had almost been trouble and wanted to leave the place of it behind.